sure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach@cfru.ca for more information.
Put your finger on the groove with Planet Groove every Friday between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. for some soul-stirring funk, rock, blues, metal, and more with your funky, funky blues doctor on the dial at CFRU 93.3 FM.
Follow the White Rabbit to the Academic Town Square in the U of G's McLaughlin Library on November 19th, 2015 from 1:30 to 2:30 for this year's Wonderland-themed What's Cooking in the Archives. This delicious tasting event showcases the Archives' extensive culinary collections and features the culinary talents of Jason Waterfall of the Woolwich Arrow. Jason will be recreating recipes found in the Alice in Wonderland themed cookbooks, as well as delicious recipes of his own. This event is accessible and guests are welcome to come in costume. An award will be given for the best dressed. Come on down to What's Cooking in the Archives on November 19th from 1:30 to 2:30.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
When I was a young man, I carried my pack, and I lived the free life of a rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, 'cause there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as we sailed away from the quay. And amidst all the tears and the shouts and the cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day, when the blood stained the sand and the water, and how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was ready, he primed himself well, he showered us with bullets and he rained us with shells, and in 5 minutes flat he'd blown us all to hell, nearly blew us right back to Australia. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as we stopped to bury our slain, and we buried ours and the Turks buried theirs, and it started all over again. Now those who were living did their best to survive in that mad world of death, blood and fire. And for 7 long weeks I kept myself alive, though the corpses around me piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me arse over tit, and when I awoke in my hospital bed and saw what it had done, Christ, I wished I was dead. Never knew there were worse things than dying. And no more I'm going to sing Matilda to the green bushes so far and near, for to hang tens and pegs a man needs two legs. No more will sing Matilda for me. So they collected the cripples, the wounded and maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The legless, the armless, the blind and insane, those proud wounded heroes of Sokla. And as our ship pulled into circular quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me to grieve and to mourn and to pity. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway, but nobody cheered, they just stood and stared, and they turned their faces away. And now every April I sit on my porch and I watch the parade pass before me. I see my own comrades, how proudly they march, reliving the dreams of past glory. I see the old men all twisted and torn, the forgotten heroes of a forgotten war. And the young people ask me, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band plays Waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But year after year, their numbers get fewer. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, ooh, go away. Sing Matilda with me.
As we advanced, German shells littered the battlefield with dead and wounded. I found a sergeant and, shouting in his ear, asked, where were his officers? All gone, sir, he shouted back. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. That was a fragment of a journal entry by Lieutenant Kevin McArdle. an Irishman serving in the British Army at the Battle of the Somme in 1916 in the heart of the First World War. In the aftermath of Remembrance Day, here on Back in the USSR, I'm taking the time to reflect on the words of this man, an Irishman, a colonial subject, fighting in the bloody interests of a colonial empire on the soil of France in a battle where more than 20,000 lives were lost on the first day alone. His last journal entry reads, "General Haig has just sent his greetings. Well done, 90th Brigade. You will attack again soon. There are only 277 of us left. We who came in, 800. Within days, McArdle too was dead. Every Remembrance Day, every anniversary of what was once called the War to End All Wars, we are subjected to the politics of remembrance. To root our historical memory, our historical sympathies, our allegiance and national identity in a war between great powers over the spoils of empire. We are told about Vimy Ridge. Passchendaele is sold to us without its mud and rain and wretchedness and blood, to use Siegfried Sassoon's words. Instead, we are told a stirring tale of glory, a story of a battle for freedom and democracy. We are told that these things are still under threat today, and that we must also celebrate the war in Afghanistan and its veterans, who supposedly follow in the same footsteps as the men of Vimy. As in every glorious war, two very big quotes around that, sold to us by the ruling class, we are shown no bodies, only heroes. No suffering, only patriotic smiles. A veil is thrown over the past. No survivors from the First World War remain to contradict the narrative. And the powers that be are free to make use of the dead as pawns in their game, enlisting new generations to die for empire in the 21st century. This is what the great Marxist historian Walter Benjamin meant when he warned us that, quote, not even the dead will be safe from the enemy if he is victorious. This enemy could be fascist, it could be conservative, it could be liberal, even social democrat, but its common purpose is to justify the horrific policies of capitalism and imperialism by appealing to the imagined past. You know, and they seek to justify murder, exploitation, and conquest with appeals to tradition and military glory. It's the same ruling class history that gives us volume after volume about empires and great men, and nothing about who paid the costs. As Michael Parenti wrote in his book, History is Mystery, he says, quote, volumes aplenty have appeared chronicling the exploits of Darius the Great, Alexander the Great, Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, Frederick the Great, and other self-styled greats whose major accomplishments were the forceful exploitation and suppression of toiling populations. Fewer have been the chroniclers who recorded how the course of history was changed by the women and men who created the crafts and generated the skills of civilization, those who developed horticulture and designed the first wagons, seafaring vessels, and fishing nets, the first looms, laths, and kilns, who cultivated the first orchards, vineyards, and terraces, discovered the use of medicinal herbs, and invented the written word, arithmetic calculations, and musical instruments, those who did what Thorsten Veblen called the work of civilization. One is reminded of Bertolt Brecht's poem, Questions from a Worker Who Reads. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with the names of kings. Was it kings who hauled the craggy loads of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who raised that city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, glittering with gold, lived those who built it? On the evening that the Wall of China was finished, where did the masons go? Philip of Spain wept when his fleet went down. Was there no one else who wept? Frederick the Great won the 7 Years' War. Who won it with him? A victory on every page. Who cooked the victory feast? A great man every 10 years. Who paid the costs? The people who do the work of civilization are forgotten. And if they are radicals, revolutionaries, socialists, and communists, they're even condemned as monsters. So we don't learn how the socialist states of the 20th century raised more people out of poverty than at any other place or time in history. And people who emigrated to Canada from former socialist states in Eastern Europe after 1989 brought the restoration of capitalism and caused their jobs to disappear. Those people are told by the powers that be in this country that everything they experienced in their homelands was a lie. You know, you were slaves, they are told. You were impoverished and suffering. Don't you remember? So they become anti-communists because that is what their new country expects of them and their historical memory. So when we remember the past, we must understand that remembrance is a political act. Who we remember, what we remember, how we remember, and for what purpose and for whose interests. And we must think of what future we want for ourselves and for our children. A world of bloodshed, hatred, exploitation, and war. Or a world without exploitation, where human needs come first, where human potential is realized, where human happiness is a reality for all of us. This is the world socialism seeks to build. The world existing socialist societies have shown the way to. And what the people of the Russian Empire, what the peoples of the Russian Empire embraced when they rejected the evil reality of World War I in 1917 and fought for something more. And we must get there. We must get there too. For as the great German communist Rosa Luxemburg said, the choice for humanity is between socialism and barbarism. And if we look at what is going around the world right now, I think that truth could not be more clear. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Well, how do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while, need the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. I hope you died well and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene?
Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last costume chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
Or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Although you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed in forever behind a glass pane? In an old photograph, torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in a brown leather frame.
Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last postern chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
o'er the green fields of France. There's a warm summer's breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas and no barbed wire, there's no gun firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. All the countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference, to his fellow man, to a whole generation that were butchered and damned.
Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
Now young Willie McBride, I can't help but wonder why. To those that lie here know, why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars?
For the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the shame, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young William McBride, it all happened again. And again, and again, and again, and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
This being a reading of the last statement of James Connolly, I quote: "To the Field General Court Martial held at Dublin Castle, May 9, 1916. We went out to break the connection between this country and the British Empire and to establish an Irish Republic. We believe the call we then issued to the people of Ireland was a nobler call and a holier cause than any call issued to them during that World War or having any connection with the war. We succeeded in proving that Irish men are ready to die, endeavouring to win for Ireland those national rights which the British government has been asking them to die to win for Belgium. As long as that remains the case, the cause of Irish freedom is safe. Believing that the British government has no right in Ireland, never had any right in Ireland, and never can have any right in Ireland. The presence in any one generation of even a respectable minority willing to die to affirm that truth makes that government forever a usurpation and a crime against human progress. I personally thank God that I have lived to see the day when thousands of Irish men and boys and hundreds of Irish women and girls were ready to affirm and to attest to that truth with their lives if need be. Signed this day, 9 May 1916. James Connolly, Commandant General, Dublin Division, Army of the Irish Republic, IRA.
Marching down Sackville Street with a starry plowing high. Here comes the citizen army with a fist raised to the sky. Leading them is a mighty man with a mad rage in his eye. My name is James Connolly, I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, this small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty. The chant goes up, all citizens, this system is a curse. An English boss is a bastard, an Irish one even worse. They'll never lock us out again, and here's the reason why. My name is James Connolly, I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, this small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty. Up steps our citizen leader, and he rose up to the sky. My name is James Connolly, I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, this small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty. We brought them to a standstill as the flames lit up the sky, till the bullet pierced our leader and we give up the fight. They shot him in Kilmainham jail, but they'll never stop his cry. My name is James Connolly, I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class, this small farmer too, to protect the proletariat from the bosses and the screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the dream. A republic for the working class, economic liberty.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
My name's Peter, and I'm on CFRU, and
you can be too. Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objet d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
It is no surprise that one of CFRU's longest-running and most popular programs is Clan na Gael. We feature 2 hours of the best Celtic music from around the world and around the corner. Listen on Sundays after the BBC World News at noon. Tune in and get your fill of fiddles, whistles, banjos, mandolins, barons, harps, flutes, and wonderful voices. And of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite Celtic musical instrument, the bagpipes. Clan na Gael is the most bagpipe-friendly show on CFRU FM 93.3. Join me, John Fahey, on Sundays and start your own Celtic Kitchen Ceilidh.
Living on Less is a free 8-week workshop series focused on helping people to be more gentle on their wallets and on the environment. Each week, various expert speakers will present on a variety of topics, such as DIY eco-cleaning products, budgeting, homemade gift-giving, ways to save on energy around the home, and more. Each workshop features a hands-on element and is great for anyone who's struggling on a budget or is just interested in being more eco-friendly in their everyday lives. Workshops run every Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8:30 beginning October 22nd until December 10th at the North Riverside Community Center, located inside Waverly Drive Public School at 140 Waverly Drive, Guelph. Event is wheelchair accessible and childcare will be provided. All participants must register as space is limited. Email livingonlessguelph1@gmail.com to register and check out facebook.com/livingonlessguelph for a full list of workshops.
Lenin! Er rührte an den Schlaf der Welt mit Worten, die Blitze waren. Sie kamen auf Schienen und Flüssen daher, durch alle Länder gefahren. Er rührte an den Schlaf der Welt mit Worten, die wurden Brot. Und Lenins Worte wurden Armeen gegen die Hungersnot. Er rührte an den Schlaf der Welt mit Worten, die wurden Maschinen. Wurden Traktoren, wurden Häuser, Bohrtürme und Minen.
Wurden Elektrizitäts, Hämmer in den Betrieben. Stehen unaus Schiff in allen Herzen geschrieben. Stehen unaus Schiff in allen Herzen geschrieben.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Once again, I am Siegfried, and that was a bit of Ernst Busch, his song about Lenin, which he did in 1950, actually in the very newly created DDR in East Germany. And one of the reasons why, like, I wanted to start with that, of course, before we heard the heard some songs, the High Kings with the Green Fields of France. We heard James Connolly's last statement, the Irish revolutionary who gave his life for the liberation of his country from the British Empire in 1916. And it's very important to note, in fact, that I was quoting Kevin McArdle, who died in the same year at the Battle of the Somme. And, how many Irish soldiers actually were killed, while fighting, basically in the British Empire's war in World War I. And that was, in fact, one of the catalysts for the Irish Rebellion and the ultimate liberation of Ireland, which, came after the war was over, but, of course, began with the Easter Rebellion in 1916. And of course, after the First World War, there was like a massive increase in the liberation struggles that were going on, the anti-colonial movements around the world. And of course, as my entire show last week actually was about, the Great October Socialist Revolution, the first socialist revolution in history, happened, of course, in 1917. you know, once again, when the Russian people rejected the First World War, they really was the most successful anti-war movement in history, at least the original movement in February of 1917, which, of course, like brought down the Tsarist government. And, of course, that was ultimately what led to the Bolshevik takeover in 1917, November 1917. So, you know, these are pivotal moments and once again showed a different way forward in human history. But as I said before, quoting Walter Benjamin, not even the dead will be safe from the enemy if he's victorious. And I just realized, given the attacks, the terrorist attacks which just happened in Paris, and now already the right wing, the fascists are basically using this to their advantage to push their line, to exploit those dead bodies for their own gain. The imperialists are using this to, of course, push more for more war in the Middle East. And we see how the dead are not safe. We see how what Walter Benjamin's, what he said is really such a timeless statement, and how it holds true even now. So I have Brendan Campisi with me now on the show to really kind of unpack this concept of terrorism and really what it means and put it in historical context for us. So welcome to the show, Brendan.
Hello, good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. It's been a while.
Huh?
Oh, I think it's good. Oh, no, wait a minute. Yeah, there we go. Sorry about that. I actually didn't have Brennan's mic turned on, which is problematic. So anyway, we have it. It's turned on now. So I will once again greet Brendan here. Brendan, how's it going?
Not too bad.
Okay, things are going well. So and once again, it's good to have you back on the show here.
Always good to be here.
Yeah. And so maybe you could start by kind of unpacking really what terrorism is, and once again put it in a historical context for us here.
Sure. So, of course, the concept of terrorism is not, in fact, one that has any kind of rigorous or scientific definition. And it's a highly political term. And it's used in ways that are very unstable and that are very contingent, depending on what political use someone is trying to make of it. That being said, definitions of terrorism usually sort of float somewhere around the use of targeted or indiscriminate violence against civilians in order to intimidate and create fear and to create, in a word, terror. As for the historical context, the term terrorism has been used for a while, and there have been sort of a number of periods in recent history or in history in the past 100 years or so when terrorism has been a significant part of political discourse, a significant topic of discussion in the media, in public opinion, and in politics. And we have been living in one of those periods for the past, well, I guess just over 14 years since the attacks of September 11th, 2001. And several times in the past few years, I have believed that the period of the war on terror, so-called, was about to end, but then something brings us back into it. And now the attacks in Paris yesterday appear to have done that. But what I would like to also discuss is sort of the previous historical period when terrorism occupied a very salient place in political discussion in the world. And that was a period from about the late 1960s into the late 1980s, or maybe the turn of the 1990s. And it's interesting and I think important to look at these two separate periods and to contrast them. Because in this first, or this previous sort of age of terrorism, the forces that were labeled as terrorist in bourgeois media and by the imperialist states were forces of a quite different character than the forces that we commonly discuss when we discuss terrorism today. Back during this period in the late 60s and the 70s, most of the forces that were discussed in terms of terrorism were progressive forces who used irregular forms of military action. And that could include anti-imperialist and communist groups like, for example, the Red Army Fraction in West Germany, the Red Brigades and other armed groups in Italy, and it also prominently included national liberation forces like the Irish Republican Movement, the ETA in the Basque Country, or the Palestinian Resistance. And there are a number of significant and qualitative differences between these kinds of progressive forces who were labeled terrorists in their time and the sort of reactionary terrorism that we deal with today. And that can be seen as, in some ways, a moral difference, but it is a difference that has a political basis and therefore ultimately a class basis. And I'm going to get into what I mean by that. So to sort of expand on that and to explain that, I'm going to look at or going to discuss a few specific cases where we can see the different behavior of so-called terrorists from the side of liberation movements and reactionary terrorism. So those cases will be the situation in Ireland, in Italy, and a couple of different points in the history of the Palestinian resistance movement. So beginning with Ireland, of course, in the six counties in Ireland, under British occupation between 1969 and 1997, there was a period of armed conflict that's become known as the Troubles. And there were, you know, there were basically two sides in this armed conflict. You had the Republican movement fighting for national liberation, fighting for Ireland to become unified. And then you had, on the other side, you had loyalist paramilitary groups and the British state. And the British state's sort of official narrative was that there were two different kinds of terrorists. There were Republican terrorists and loyalist terrorists, and they were neutral intermediaries. They were the legitimate state. You know, the people who were attacking them were just criminals rather than people fighting any kind of political cause, certainly rather than, you know, soldiers fighting in an army for national liberation. But obviously that's definitely open to challenge. And what we see when we look at sort of these two different groups, and I am going to explain why I say two groups and rather than three, why I don't see the loyalists and the British state as separate, is some pretty significant differences in terms of the way they went about their, you know, pursuing their agendas in this armed conflict. So the Republican movement essentially fought a guerrilla war. Most of their action involved armed attacks on the British Army and the police. So it involved armed attacks on state forces, which is only terrorism by the most tendentious and biased definition possible. It's only terrorism if you accept 100% the legitimacy of the British state in Northern Ireland, and you really do agree with them and you believe that the Irish Republican movement are criminals. If you can even be impartial in the conflict, you have to recognize that these are in essence acts of war. The Republican movement also did engage in a number of attacks on British politicians. Most notably, the IRA made an assassination attempt on Margaret Thatcher in 1984. The IRA successfully carried out an assassination of Lord Mountbatten in 1979. And I believe in the same year, in 1979, the Irish National Liberation Army assassinated a conservative minister, Éirí Neave, a conservative minister and former spy. And of course, the British state would also call this terrorism. But in fact, these were not civilians who were being taken out in these operations. These were servants and operatives and members of the British ruling class. And incidentally, it's pretty nasty people. Lord Mountbatten had been the British military commander in India during the Second World War, and he was responsible, or had a hand in, at least, the deaths of millions of people in the famine that took place in Bengal during the Second World War, as a direct result of British military and government policy. And he also had a political hand in the partition of the Indian subcontinent, which led to the death and displacement of millions of people. So, not an innocent person being murdered by terrorists, but a member of the British ruling class, with blood on his hands. And when the Irish Republican Army did engage in attacks on civilian targets in Britain, the goal, the object, was never to kill civilians. The object was to damage economic infrastructure, always. And there was a standard practice by the IRA of phoning ahead when they were going to bomb a civilian target an hour and a half in advance, which gave the authorities time to evacuate people so that no one would die. It also, of course, gave the authorities time to look for the bomb and find it and defuse it. So the IRA was willing to jeopardize the effectiveness of its own operations in order to save civilian life, because they understood that the British working class was not their enemy, that ordinary people in Britain were not their enemies, and they had absolutely no desire to kill or harm ordinary people in Britain. And they, in fact, recognized that it would be harmful for them to do so. Now, there were mistakes. There were incidents where British police and British authorities failed to evacuate a building on time, for example. And there were incidents where sort of disgruntled groups within the Republican movement carried out attacks without following these norms. And there were, of course, incidents where British civilians were killed, including some incidents where British civilians were killed in significant numbers. But what should be recognized is that those things were deviations from policy set by the Republican movement, or they were actual mistakes by groups of people who had actually, you know, intended an evacuation to be carried out successfully, or what have you. And there were, in the six counties, incidents of sectarian violence being perpetrated by Republicans. But again, that was a violation of official policy of the Irish Republican Army, which said, which explicitly forbid sectarian attacks on Protestants as such. And the Republican movement, of course, has always included Protestants and not been sectarian. But the fact is, when sectarian violence did occur from the Republican side, it was a degeneration from their usual practice, and it was a violation of their rules. On the Loyalist side, things were very, very different. And this is where I think you can start to call something terrorism. Because the modus operandi of the Loyalist armed groups in Northern Ireland, overwhelmingly, was simply to kill Catholic civilians because they were Catholic civilians. They would go into bars that were, you know, known in the community as Catholic or Republican, and they would open fire. That was a standard type of operation. And often they would say that they were targeting some known local Republican, but they weren't there. And it was clear to everyone what the real goal was. The goal was simply to intimidate the nationalist community in Northern Ireland out of supporting the Republican movement. So there you have targeted violence against civilians for the purpose of instilling terror. So again, many conventional definitions of terrorism will sort of cohere around those elements. So we can definitely call that terrorism. The statistics, the way it breaks down, is that the majority of people killed by armed Republican action during the Troubles were British state forces, whereas the overwhelming majority, something like 80% or more, of people killed by Loyalist action were random Catholic civilians. And this is a period or a wave of terrorism that the British state, in fact, has a hand in, because what investigations have increasingly turned up since the 1990s is deep, deep collusion between the British state and these Loyalist groups. What they found was that, especially in the 1970s, a group of people in the British state, in the army, the police, the intelligence services, were working with a group of Loyalist terrorists to commit sectarian atrocities and to keep the conflict going. And this group of people actually committed the most pure act of terrorism during the Troubles, which was two bombings that took place in the cities in the Republic of Ireland, in Dublin and Monaghan, in May of 1974, in which 33 people were killed. And in those incidents, car bombs were detonated in city centers during rush hour when there were sort of a maximum number of pedestrians out in the street. And the object was to kill as many people as possible in order to scuttle a political arrangement that might have been reached at that time with the Republican movement and the Irish state, and that could have potentially formed some sort of political solution to the conflict in Northern Ireland. But elements of the British ruling class and the British state apparatus, who were opposed to a political solution at that time and wanted a military solution, scuttled that with the single deadliest and most unambiguous act of terrorism during that entire conflict. So I think the differences in that situation are very, very clear. So the next situation that I think it's useful to look at is, again, where there's both leftist terrorism, so to speak, and right-wing terrorism operating in the same situation, is in Italy. Italy in the 1970s was full of political violence. Political violence became a feature of life in Italy in the 1970s, as it did in no other Western country, perhaps outside of occupied Ireland itself. It wasn't quite at that level. But in terms of the large Western countries, Italy was by far the most violent. And we can see, again, a very clear difference between what came to be known in Italy in these years as red terrorism from the left and black terrorism from the right. So there were a number of armed leftist groups in Italy during these years. The Red Brigades are the most famous one. There's also a group called La Prima Linea, the front line. And there are also armed groups in the autonomous movement. The autonomous movement was sort of a very broad and diffuse collection of different groups with varying kinds of politics and practice. But some of those groups included armed ones. And these armed groups had actually developed in a fairly organic way out of the extraordinarily militant struggles of the Italian working class at this time. So there was a wave of strikes and industrial struggle in Italy from the late 1960s into the 70s. And that often got very, very heated. There were frequent clashes with police. There were frequent sort of incidents of kidnapping and intimidation of particularly egregious bosses and foremen. And the very first actions of the armed groups developed out of that, where before, let's say, you know, an abusive foreman would simply have been kidnapped and maybe just intimidated a bit but not seriously harmed, the emerging armed groups in the early 70s might abduct someone in the same situation and kneecap them. Eventually, as the space for radical political advance in Italy seemed to close over the course of the 1970s. The violence escalated. And by the end, you have the Red Brigades engaging in all manner of violence against the Italian state itself. But for most of this period, what they did was very selective. It was, again, similarly to the Republican movement, the targeted assassination of political figures, of politicians and judges and police chiefs and members of the state apparatus. Whereas the terrorist right in Italy, again, provides a sharp contrast. Right-wing terrorism in Italy started first. The very first notable act of terrorism in Italy during this period was in December 1969, when a bomb went off in a plaza, the Piazza Fontana, in Milan. And it killed 16 people, most of whom were farmers, lining up outside of a bank for farmers, depositing their weekly earnings from the farmers market. And at first, a couple of anarchists were arrested for the bombing, and they were framed, and one of them was murdered by the police. But that's besides the point for now. The point is that this was actually planned by a group of neo-fascists who were frightened by the workers' movement as it was developing in Italy. And they developed what was called the Italian far right, elements of the Italian state, and very likely American intelligence helped them, developed what was called the strategy of tension, which was to carry out terrorist attacks in order to create a climate of fear and insecurity and blame it on the left and encourage the Italian state to crack down on the workers' movement, crack down on the left, and basically revert to fascism. This was sort of a strategic option that was being developed by a significant section of the Italian ruling class at the time. So in the course of that, they did not carry out, you know, targeted assassinations. They did sometimes engage in selective violence against the left, but what they did that the leftists did not was to simply engage in massive targeted violence against large groups of civilians simply for the purpose of creating terror. And the worst act of terrorism in Italy during these years was the massacre that was carried out in Bologna in August in 1980, where a bomb was set off in a waiting room at a train station where people were packed in because it was the only room in the station that had air conditioning, and it was the middle of the summer. And 85 people were killed in that attack. So again, we can see the sort of the particularly vicious character of reactionary terrorism that seeks to kill large numbers of random innocent people simply in order to create fear and to create, you know, chaos and insecurity. Even the Italian prime minister at the time, a very, very conservative Christian democratic politician named Francisco Cossiga, pointed out almost as soon as the bombing had happened, that he was fairly certain that it was right-wing terrorism rather than leftist terrorism, because as he said, leftist terrorism strikes at the state through its representatives, where right-wing terrorism is indiscriminate and simply seeks to create fear. So even an Italian bourgeois politician was able to recognize the difference in practice, even though, of course, he would have considered them both, you know, terrorist menaces, and probably would have seen the left as the greater one. And what we've learned since 1990, although we haven't nearly learned enough, is that this sort of strategy, and there were other incidents in other Western European countries, and a similar pattern of right-wing terrorism in Turkey during the same years, was that a lot of this is connected to Gladio, which was this sort of subversive network that was set up by NATO after the Second World War under the guise of preparing for a resistance movement against a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Now, as we know, the Soviet invasion of Western Europe was never going to happen. And it's very likely that NATO knew this as well. And what these Gladio networks ended up being turned to was the class war within their countries and political violence against the left within their countries. There's a problem with Gladio in that the Americans refuse to turn over any kind of information. Similarly, the British government refuses to turn over any kind of information about Dublin and Monaghan. Mm-hmm. And any inquiries into collusion between the British state and the Loyalists have been stonewalled to no end. So in both of these cases, we know there's enough evidence that these imperialist states have, you know, had substantial ties to these violent reactionary forces, and then they bear a substantial responsibility for this violence. But we don't have smoking guns in a lot of situations simply because they refuse to turn over the evidence that exists. But that's what I would like to say about the Italian situation. It's also, I think, indicative to examine a couple of points in the history of the Palestinian resistance movement. So right. The Palestinian resistance movement sort of became known as one of the more sort of popularly and widely sort of denounced terrorist forces in Western politics and in the Western media in the late 60s and the 1970s. But the Palestinian terrorism of the 60s and 70s was, compared to the terrorism that we see today, almost peaceful. It was essentially demonstrative. The point was to get a message out into the media, to get a message out into public opinion. So you'd have airplane hijackings, the goal of which was simply to raise awareness of, you know, the situation of Palestinian political prisoners and to demand, you know, a certain group of people be released or what have you. And this went along with guerrilla war in Palestine. You know, it went along with guerrilla attacks within, you know, the occupied territory of Palestine. It went along with armed resistance within within Lebanon and in Jordan. So there were different kinds of armed action being carried out by the Palestinian resistance. But obviously some of this can in no way be called terrorism at all. And when, in the course of these actions by the Palestinian resistance, civilians were killed, this was, again, akin to the Republican movement, virtually always a mistake. One of the most notorious acts of terrorism during this period, the so-called Munich Olympics massacre, was not intended as, you know, the killing of these Israeli athletes that had been taken hostage. So a Palestinian resistance group called Black September, which had a sort of ambiguous relationship with the official PLO. There's debates over whether it was simply, you know, some members of Fatah doing something that they wouldn't want Fatah to be associated with, or whether it was a rogue group. But in any case, they took a number of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics hostage, and they demanded in return a couple of hundred Palestinian political prisoners be freed. And obviously, their intention was to have this go off successfully. But because the West German police and the Israeli military, who were in Munich, failed to rescue the hostages, but succeeded in sort of backing the hostage takers into a corner, where they were trapped, but they weren't, but they hadn't been captured. They created a situation where these hostages ended up being killed. And it's interesting. I've read a bit of material from the European revolutionary left in the aftermath of that incident, debating it. And there were many people who said, you know, this was counterproductive, this was a mistake. But there were also voices that could be heard defending it, even defending the way everything turned out. There was, of course, sort of a new revolutionary movement that had developed in Western Europe.